His last words to me was telling me that he loved me, and I had gone on a trip, and I had come back and getting that news that he had taken his life. And yet you could feel that he was on the up, meaning he was coming out of it and healing and getting better and getting stable.
I think at this point, my biggest fear is that this is the new normal, and I don't know how long you can survive on the street. So my biggest fear is she'll die on the street.
Welcome to Look Again, Mental Illness Reexamined. In this episode, we will be covering a very challenging topic related to mental illness, suicide.
This will be part one of a two-episode conversation. We understand that the subject matter can be triggering for some listeners, so please take caution and care if you choose to listen.
So here we go. There are some pretty alarming statistics between serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and suicide rates. Studies show that up to 15% of individuals with schizophrenia will die by suicide, often within the first 10 years of onset. And approximately 40 to 60% of people with schizophrenia will attempt suicide, with young people disproportionately affected.
This information prompted us to discuss suicide and severe and persistent mental illness on Look Again. To help us navigate this sensitive topic, we are joined by Dr. William Honer. Dr. Honer is a professor and Jack Bell Chair in Schizophrenia Research at the University of British Columbia's Department of Psychiatry. He brings us a wealth of knowledge and expertise, shedding light on the factors behind the higher suicide rates among those with schizophrenia. Dr. Honer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay, Dr. Honer. So as we mentioned earlier, individuals with schizophrenia have a much higher risk of dying by suicide, particularly within that first 10 years of onset. What factors contribute to these high statistics?
So it is a challenge. It is a problem. And we need to look at it, but we have to put it in the context of other problems that people with schizophrenia have and we have in providing care. So just to give a bit of context or a different kind of perspective. Again, as researchers, we talk about a statistical sense of things. It really has to be looked at in the broader context of how much weight do we put on it? How important is it in terms of the needs of our patients and in terms of how our system of care can do its best to provide for those needs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you for that context. And it's important that we talk about the facts and hear from you as a researcher in this area and has been involved in this area for decades. But there has been a big emphasis on suicide prevention over the past 30 and 40 years. But it seems, at least from an outside perspective, that the incidence of suicide has not declined. In fact, it's increasing, especially between those teens and youth ages. So I'm interested to hear more about the numbers that we're seeing. It seems that the numbers are increasing, not decreasing.
So let's look at the results that Dr. Kurdiak, who's a very good researcher, talked about in terms of the Ontario studies. The risk was highest in those who were 26 to 35 or those who were 36 to 45 relative compared with those who were 16 to 25 when they started. I mean, usually we think about youth as being 16 to 25. But what we're seeing here is that it's actually the somewhat older, not that being 26 is old, but in terms of the young people, it's really not that youth group, 16 to 25, that seems to be of highest risk. So we need to just think about that and think about what's different about someone who develops schizophrenia at age 26 or older compared to someone who develops schizophrenia at 16 or so? How do we more personalize the care and develop systems of care that will take that into account?
What are your thoughts on why that slightly older demographic than youth, there is a higher risk?
One thing with people who develop schizophrenia at 26 or older than that, they've had different life experiences than those who develop schizophrenia earlier. And we have a lot of concern in general about when schizophrenia starts in adolescence, in teenage years, about the social disruptions, about the ability to complete education, get work, and these kind of things. But you look at somebody who's 26, 35 who develops schizophrenia, they've had different life experiences. And so the onset of schizophrenia and having to cope with this illness, it has different factors psychologically, different ways of thinking about it and so on. In fact, we have a lot of discussion in the field about agnosognosia and lack of insight into illness. But it seems in terms of those patients with schizophrenia who die by suicide, they probably had more insight into illness, actually. And you've got to think about how having had different life experiences, you maybe got through school, you maybe did have some work, you maybe had a relationship if you're in your 20s, early 30s when you develop schizophrenia, and you might get the idea that, whoa, that's all coming to an end or something. The work that we have to do to help people adapt to this onset of illness when they have more insight into it, the implications of what it could be, we need to work with that in a different way. The other things, though, not to forget about, those who don't have insight into having schizophrenia, who don't have well-treated psychotic symptoms, as we know, sometimes there can be voices that are commanding to harm self, or there can be delusions, misunderstandings of reality that lead to patients with schizophrenia, sometimes putting themselves at risk of death when that wasn't even their intent. That lack of insight can create risk. Really, it is in the early phases of illness, getting as good an understanding of what the implications are, of what the protective ways to armor oneself against hopelessness, against isolation, and trying to, again, hopefully with social support, complete education and have work experiences. Those are going to be protective things to engender a sense of hope and optimism about the future, rather than hopelessness and despair.
Yeah, and Dr. Hohner, you talked about different life experiences, and we've read that social and economic isolation experienced by people living with schizophrenia is highlighted as one of those potential major risk factors that does contribute to those higher suicide rates. So what do you think is the relationship between social isolation and suicidal tendencies for people living with severe and persistent mental illnesses?
So it gets tricky because as part of the diagnosis of schizophrenia, we have to have the criteria that there's a significant impairment in social or occupational function. So did they slip into a lower socioeconomic status because of the illness itself? It's kind of cause and effect. Does lower socioeconomic status predispose to risk of dying by suicide? It just makes common sense that somebody who's socially isolated, who has few financial means, those are stressors. And stressors are part of what leads to the transition from what we call suicidal ideation, thinking about suicide, to making an attempt. The stressors are important in that kind of transition. So yeah, coming around to your question, those are stressors and they are part of what's going on. But we need to think about, is that what's different about schizophrenia that we need to think about in terms of providing care and understanding the individual risk factors that could be contributing to suicidal ideation and to making an attempt and to actually dying by suicide?
So just hypothesizing, we talk a lot about the importance of family support. And I know the amount of involvement my parents maybe had when I was in my late teens versus now in my late 20s, they're not the same. I am a lot more independent. So if someone's maybe experiencing symptoms and the first onset of the illness older, they maybe don't necessarily have the same family involvement to the same capacity. Do you think that might play a role in this?
Sure. It could be one of those things that makes a difference. And in terms of older people, older youth, they may have moved away from home. They may have moved to take work or to go to school outside of their immediate environment, and the amount of contact they may have with families is just different, as it is for many young people. It's one of those things that we don't know how much family involvement there was or was not with those people. It's part of the challenge in terms of looking at what are the risk factors or potentially protective factors in terms of things. Certainly, where family members have a closer connection and are living day to day with a person with schizophrenia who they have more understanding of what's going on in their mental state, being able to provide that information to the healthcare providers could be really helpful in terms of alerting them to changes or to things that they may have missed. We saw in the data that it's close to half or so of patients who had schizophrenia who died due to suicide, they had been in care in the 30 days prior to death. How good was that care? Were the caregivers aware that there was suicidal ideation? We don't know those kind of things. We know they had contact, but was that contact inclusive of family members in terms of getting more boots on the ground kind of information about things in terms of understanding? Is there more distress at this time that leads to this transition from thinking passively about suicide to making a plan to making an attempt? Those are things we can't be sure about from the data that we've got.
Yeah. And Dr. Hohner, you had talked before, and I thought that was brilliant, that we have to remember that behind those numbers are individuals. Behind those statistics and data are families and people living with a serious mental illness. So those families dealing with a loved one with schizophrenia is challenging enough. So what can families do to protect themselves emotionally, especially knowing these higher suicide rates, while also providing that necessary support to their loved one living with the illness?
I think that's part of the work of the schizophrenia societies, the family members feeling that they aren't alone, that they're not the only family that's experiencing this. We help each other in this kind of a way and so on. And it is still a, hesitate to say mysterious, but it is not well understood sort of changes that lead to someone with schizophrenia considering suicide or making an attempt. We don't understand those things really well. And so families certainly can't be blaming themselves for these sort of very unfortunate, the worst catastrophic events that happened. And it's something that challenges us, I think, as mental health professionals as well. We share in this difficulty in terms of prediction and in terms of understanding how quickly things can change in terms of someone's thinking about self-harm. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice for how family members can help ensure their loved one's well-being and safety?
Well, a lot of it is, I think, trying to help with the care providers in the system, providing information that the healthcare provider might not get directly themselves in terms of things. To me, the engagement of a person with schizophrenia with the healthcare system, is it with an individual? Is there an identified person who's in the system that they can see regularly, that they can have, feel like that doctor is really looking out for them and doing the best things that are possible for them? It's this quality of the care, the frequency of the care, and what medications are involved, and are the other contributing risk factors, such as substance use disorders, as mood disorders, a history of suicide attempts, and so on. Are those things being looked at? Is the care comprehensive in that kind of a way? Because we know that there's one medication that is indicated for individuals with schizophrenia who have suicidal ideation and are at risk, and that medication is clozapine. It's the only antipsychotic that does seem to be effective in decreasing the amount of suicidal ideation, the amount of suicidal attempts that patients who are at risk for this have. So it is really advocating for those things with the care-providing team, providing, oh, by the way, they have schizophrenia and they're depressed this month too. This has changed. This is different, because you can sometimes focus on things that are the psychotic symptoms, the negative symptoms, but mood symptoms need to be looked at too. And where family members know something about the mood symptoms, know something about the substance use, that can really be helpful in terms of understanding those risk factors need to be looked at, and the care needs to be comprehensive, not only on the psychotic symptoms or so that a person may be experiencing.
Just another reminder, Dr. Hohner, of the importance of having family involvement.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You're listening to Look Again, Mental Illness Reexamined. a podcast about mental illness brought to you by the BC Schizophrenia Society and our BC partner organizations. I'm Phaedra Aldridge.
And I'm Melissa McKenna. We're in the middle of a conversation with Dr. Bill Hohner talking about the increased risk of suicide among people with schizophrenia.
So Dr. Hohner, as a professor and a psychiatrist for a long time, what changes, if any, have you noticed over the years in terms of suicide rates?
The amount of variability that happens in this, it's hard to identify trends. We lack registries of patients with schizophrenia that could be better integrated with the mental health care system. We have the Center for Disease Control has a kind of registry that identified, for example, the greater risk of death during the heat crisis a couple summers ago in people with schizophrenia. That is an example of how things, if the registry between schizophrenia in British Columbia, Alberta, Manitoba, some of these things might need to be combined together for us to really understand if there are indeed trends for better or worse. Has the implementation of early psychosis programs made a difference? With this kind of data where we pool things together across provinces and come together in terms of trying to understand the nature of our systems, that's what we really need to know whether we're making a difference in terms of these kind of rates for suicide as a cause of death.
What do you think the role that public advocacy can play in raising awareness, reducing stigma, and improving the access to healthcare resources?
I think it's looking for accountability in terms of the new initiatives, the programs, and those kind of things. And we have a great deal of emphasis on youth programs, on first episode psychosis. But the data says it's age 26 and older that is at the greatest risk of death due to suicide. And so it's just sort of thinking about, okay, well then, is that emphasis on youth and first episode, is that going to help? If there's an age limit of 26, you're no longer eligible for first episode psychosis. The greatest time after identifying schizophrenia as the illness was 4 years. That 4 years later was the peak of death due to suicide. So it's thinking about the lifetime course of the illness and the bigger picture of who is at risk for the illness and how we have to look at individualizing care for them, not thinking that only one approach is going to solve everything. That's really our challenge, and that there are not simple answers to these complex questions, and we've got to be in it for the long haul.
And when you talk about the one approach, we've heard that there's some people have been advocating to have specific prevention programs targeting specific populations rather than having that more general approach to interventions. So what are your thoughts on tailoring interventions to better reach certain demographics in terms of suicide rates?
I think we absolutely have to tailor interventions, but it is then at what kind of denominator level we have to tailor interventions. Mm-hmm. I'm a physician, and as doctors, we treat one patient at a time. Mm-hmm. And so I think these kind of things, we can't forget the importance of that relationship that doctors have with patients and that individual engagement, that individual patient has to be looked at in the context of their family. That's an important part of that. And so I'm a little hesitant about saying, well, okay, we need a separate women's program for schizophrenia. We need a separate this for schizophrenia. We lose the cross-fertilization, the overall kind of concepts. When we divide things into groups, we lose power. We lose advocacy when we're only focused on one particular group or one particular type of things. If we divide things up smaller and smaller and restrict access, I don't like that somehow. I think to really provide individual personalized care, you do have to be aware of the differences between people and their experiences that may be because they are perceived by society as being in a group that has features that are different. So I think still that individual relationship in between a patient and a caregiver is really something that's important, and the continuity of that so that they can be sure they're going to be seeing a person that they've developed a relationship with over time. And those are really important things.
I appreciate that perspective as a physician, looking at each person as an individual and what will work best for them, because I also am concerned that if we have too many small tailored programs, especially in remote communities where it's hard enough getting any sort of programs, if we're excluding a certain amount of a demographic, it's not helping enough people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious to know, Melissa, your thoughts on this, because I know Dr. Honer and I are closer in age than you and I are. Suicide wasn't talked about when I was younger. Suicide was never talked about amongst my friend group. It was never discussed in school. So I'm curious, Melissa, to hear your thoughts on what you've noticed as a younger person.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I know just even from talking with my parents, the changes in the messaging. I do think there is still a long way to go as far as the messaging we're putting out. It's one thing to acknowledge and admit and talk about suicide versus being in a place where we can say, here are concrete resources, not a 6-8 month wait list. So I think there is room to grow.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I'm so happy we're having this conversation, because as Dr. Honer, you said, numbers haven't declined and we have been trying different approaches. So I think we have to try different things to reach people to try and reduce these numbers. And as you said, Dr. Honer, for the physician to continue working with the individual living with the illness, but also the family members. And that's where the family has to step in and really pay attention. And that's why it's so important to talk about these issues so that families are aware, because I think suicide is something that's still really stigmatized. And we don't want to talk about it. It'd be much easier not to talk about suicide. So that's why I'm really glad we're having this somewhat difficult conversation and a very difficult topic, because we have to keep talking about this topic.
Yeah, I think there are ways perhaps to, on a one-to-one level, ask questions that are more likely to foster a sense of engagement and find out things. So asking patients if they have thoughts of harming themselves. So are you suicidal? I mean, that's not going to get you very far, right? But if you think about, have you had thoughts of harming yourself? Have you had any plans of harming yourself? Have you wished you were dead ever? Have you ever thought it'd be good to go to sleep and not wake up? These are kind of ways to maybe engage that are less threatening or categorical in a way, because to find out about what someone's inner experience is like or so on. And then if you're getting yes answers to those kind of things, then you get into more about thinking about killing yourself and did you have a plan for that or those sort of things. That's ways of finding out about that. And sure, with people, it's going right back to the beginning. You had thoughts about harming yourself, or because the other side of that is, have you had thoughts about protecting yourself in terms of looking after yourself? What are your thoughts about how you do that too? So there's a yin and yang about it in terms of those sort of things. We want to know both whether patients are thinking about harming themselves and to what extent are they thinking about protecting themselves and looking after themselves, and how can we help better with that? What are they not getting in terms of being able to look after themselves? So those are just ways of thinking about the extremes or the ends of what we want to know.
Extending off of that, rather than just looking at from the physician's perspective of what questions we're asking, I think even family members can do that. Instead of going, how are you doing? And getting an okay, asking a little bit more of an in-depth, have you been sleeping lately? Have you been eating? Questions like that maybe open up the conversation more.
And just begin to normalize discussions and those serious questions, like whether it be, are you eating? But also, as you said, Dr. Honer, have you had any thoughts about not waking up tomorrow morning?
And we don't want to create a perception about how is your illness going, or you have schizophrenia and how are you doing? So it's like, how are you today in the here and now? Today, have things been different for you? And trying to keep a bit of a future orientation too, because that's so important in terms of understanding suicidal ideation and hopelessness or depressed mood and those sort of things. How do people feel about the future right now? Those are things that help give reason for a person to reflect on their own feelings and their own sense of optimism or pessimism and hope or hopelessness. Those are things now that we want to know about day to day, and those kind of things is really important because it shows you care about the person and you're engaged with them. You have some understanding of their experience. It helps to talk about how you're feeling and your experiences and so on. I don't think that it's necessary to have a specific focus on self-harm and those kind of things, unless there's some reason that you think there is a risk that's higher in terms of if you're getting a sense of demoralization and a sense of difficulty coping with what happened in the hospital or happened that led to going to the hospital. That's something you might want to follow up on. It just keeps you engaged, keeps you understanding, and demonstrates to that person that you care about them and you're interested in how they're feeling, what their thoughts are. That's the bigger context of, I think, trying to be helpful and to protect against the development of things like suicidal ideation, of hopelessness, of a sense of isolation that will be increasing risk. And then in terms of mood, if you get answers, yeah, I'm feeling hopeless. Well, how long has this been going on for? Mm-hmm. Is this just, well, I was fine 2 hours ago, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. Or no, it's been a couple of weeks I've been feeling this way. Okay, well, that's different too. So following up on things to understand what somebody's going through or what their positive or negative mental experiences are today, yesterday, tomorrow.
Yeah, we all have fluctuations.
Absolutely.
Now let's get back to the system level, Dr. Hohner. How do we inform public health policies and mental health services to help reduce the risk of suicide? And what differences do you think that should be made at that system level to improve the statistics around suicide, to improve the increased involvement with family members?
The public health policies, I would say, can you provide us with better information in terms of trying to advocate for a registry-based approach, to advocate for looking at suicide as a cause of death and looking at trends over time, trying to be inclusive of information from other jurisdictions where there's too small numbers within one province or so on. That's a bit the policies. I'd like to see more access to that kind of information and collecting that information in a way that we could draw some conclusions from it. And in terms of the services, I think it is taking into account some of the information that work from the big samples in Ontario has looked at in terms of considering that this really is an illness that not only has a peak in terms of new onset at age 20 or 22, maybe for women, but it happens in those that are older as well, and that our services need to take into account things other than hard dividing lines between age and how long care is provided for, with consistency of care and consistency of caregiving in the way that our services are designed. Not you've aged out, you're going into this part of the system now, and those kind of things. So that's what I'd like to see in terms of how public health and the information that's collected and the acknowledgement within our services that schizophrenia itself is something that doesn't fit easily into age bins or into short, and short being 3 years of consistent care. It may need longer than that. My work is largely consulting on what we call treatment-resistant psychosis, those who don't respond to most antipsychotic medications. And I do think that the access of patients to clozapine as part of their care system, we could look at that too in terms of the overall mental health services. And that is still underprescribed because it is the only antipsychotic that is helpful for those who have suicidal ideation or made suicide attempts, as well as being helpful for those who don't respond well to other medications.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there's the hesitancy to prescribe clozapine, Dr. Hohner?
Again, there's not one answer to it. It's an old medication. It doesn't have patent protection anymore. Clozapine does have challenges in terms of prescribing, in terms of side effects, in terms of tolerability with patients and so on, especially for physicians who aren't experienced with using it kind of thing in terms of our systems of training and of exposure of trainees to using this medication, as well as other things like neurostimulation in our system. We're not quite as cutting edge as we might be in terms of how to properly use some of the older medications. And frankly, we have challenges, I think, in terms of integrating some of the new medications outside of general psychiatry now in terms of ketamine, in terms of the possibilities with some of the psychedelic drugs and so on, integrating these with our system and providing access to cutting edge technologies and the neurostimulation as well is something that I think we could be doing better in terms of getting access to that and really looking at how much of a difference does it make? Because if some of these new things are not making a difference, we shouldn't be paying for them. We shouldn't be including them in our armamentarium. Having more evidence-based care and ongoing collection of information to tell us if there is evidence that our care is working is part of what we need to do. And we haven't had that culture enough in terms of psychiatry and in terms of the funders for our healthcare system, in my opinion.
Well, as we know that a lot of research is showing that dollars and research for schizophrenia has decreased significantly over the past few decades rather than increasing. So let's hope those numbers can start to balance out a little bit more over the upcoming years.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Dr. Honer, well, thank you so much for being here today with us. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you and for lending us your expertise on this very sensitive, but also very important topic.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation. And I think it's to the credit of the organization that you're willing to take on challenges and talk about things that really need to be spoken about and can make a difference for patients and their families with the illness.
And a huge thanks to you, our audience, for joining us for this episode. Together, we can better understand and change the narrative around mental illnesses like schizophrenia.
To get our latest podcast episode, be sure to hit follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please seek help. For the National Suicide Crisis Helpline, dial 988, or if immediate help is needed, please dial 911.
And our next episode will be the second part of this discussion, where we will be having a very open conversation with former NHL goalie Corey Hirsch about his mental illness journey. Be sure to join us for that vulnerable and very honest conversation. Thank you for listening and for being a part of this important conversation today. Talk to you soon.
This podcast is brought to you by the BC Schizophrenia Society and the BC Partners for Mental Health and Substance Use Information. We're a group of nonprofit agencies providing good quality information to help individuals and families maintain or improve their mental well-being. The BC Partners members are Anxiety Canada, BC Schizophrenia Society, Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research, Canadian Mental Health Association's BC Division, Family Smart, Jesse's Legacy, the North Shore Family Services Program, and Mood Disorders Association of BC, a branch of Lookout Housing and Health Society. The BC Partners are funded and stewarded by BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services, an agency of the Provincial Health Services Authority. For more information, visit heretohelp.bc.ca.